this week in the markets, gold touched a 10-month record high, while U.S. equities recorded a 9-week winning streak. Well, welcome back to Gold Seek Radio, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczyk. Just a pleasure to be back with you on this season 14, episode 684 show. I think it was kind of a good week for practically every investor. So with that type of good news, it's just a real pleasure to welcome back. I think it's safe to call a show mentor. Dr. Stephen Leeb has dedicated so much of his time. He's recovering from an illness and he gives us an hour. I had to break up the show because he is a dynamo of a guest. So he has an even more robust outlook on precious metals this time around. He says the trade war between the U.S. and China, non-event. And guess what? So does our good friend Michael Pinto returns to the show with literally one half of his brain tied behind his back. Michael Pinto of Pinto Portfolio Strategies is certainly emerging as a top market pundit and frankly forecaster with an unrivaled multivariate forecasting model that we've discussed a touch off air. Mr. Pinto graciously outlines his current portfolio strategy in detail. And the Q&A hotline, we'd like for you to call in, please, 641-715-3900, followed by extension number 514049. You can address the question to our guest if you like, and we'd really like to field your questions and comments. And of course, Robert Ian wraps up the show, the trooper as usual. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Visibility virtually unlimited over the precious metals sector this week as investors sent gold soaring to a 10-month record high, shrugging off more hawkish Fed rhetoric, focusing instead on the positive trade talks that have put the U.S. currency under pressure. At this week's closing bell, all of the precious metals indices finished stronger, with the yellow metal at $13.32, up a few dollars. Silver also gained 17 cents, finishing just shy of $16 an ounce. The precious metals shares index up about 4%, $3.7861. Black gold added 2% at $57.26. What a recovery from 42, pushing now towards 60. And palladium up $55, $14.62. It's $100 over gold now, a new all-time record high by more than $60. And its sister metal, platinum, now metal to watch as well, jumped 5%, about $40, looking solid at $8.45 an ounce. In related economic news, the U.S. Federal Reserve released its meeting minutes this week, and it surprised some investors, caught them a bit off guard, a little bit more of a hawkish outlook, suggesting policymakers might not be finishing with the rate hike cycle after all. However, a quick glance here at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange Group's Fed Funds futures contracts do not reflect this impression, I think, at all. It really hints at rates remaining stubbornly or sticky, you might say, at the 2.25 to 2.5% on the benchmark overnight lending rate for the rest of this year. Bottom line on precious metals. I keep echoing Jim Cramer's sentiments that he likes gold, and he's just been right. He's still calling, from what I understand, for 1400, 1500 gold. So are both my guests this week, I think. The technical picture certainly looks good on all of the indexes. Moving on to the Wall Street report, sunny skies persisted over Wall Street, with the major indices posting the 9th consecutive gain, weekly winning close, in anticipation of this weekend's scheduled meeting between China's top official in Washington. The New York Stock Exchange on Friday's closing bell, the Dow was up about 150, ending at 2631. Meanwhile, the S&P 500 picked up 67 points at 2792, and the NASDAQ, indomitable, gained 55 points, 7527. The top story moving the markets. U.S. currency lost momentum, as I mentioned, on solid U.S.-China tariff talks, or at least expected tariff talks, between the U.S. president and China's vice premier, their top negotiator, Liu Hixet. According to media sources, we could have a breakthrough this weekend, just in time to bypass the March 1st deadline, where tariffs could increase by another 15% on about $200 billion in imports from China. Turning to shares in the news, Apple, Microsoft leading the market higher. Microsoft, of course, one of our very favorite alpha stocks candidates now for at least a year or two, and it continues to impress. U.S. shares, bottom line. The greed fear index suggests the herd is a bit over-optimistic, I'd say here, but not really ebullient just yet. From a technical perspective, shares are certainly in need of a consolidation, but they're not taking my advice. The technical picture in the S&P, Dow, and comp, of course, equally solid across the board. I don't see any real waning momentum for the time being. I'm going to remain in the neutral camp, cautiously optimistic. Coming up after the break for Gold Seek Radio.
It's a pleasure to welcome back Michael Pinto of Pinto Portfolio Strategies, being gracious enough to give us a weekend interview because your guest has jury duty this week. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me back on, Chris.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
With you.
A lot going in the markets. People noticed that China and our POTUS still can't come to terms. So we still have this trade war issue. There's concerns about the, I want to say, $200 billion hitting China, 15% bump up in the tariffs there, but 15% increase from current tariff rates.
Here's my visceral response. I don't like trade wars. Trade wars are very bad. Tariffs are very bad. But the reason why a trade war is bad and the reason why tariffs are bad is because it curtails global trade. That's the reason why you would fear a trade war, because it brings down global trade. That's not at all what has happened. As a matter of fact, let me go out on a limb here and tell you, Chris, that this trade war has actually boosted GDP globally temporarily because of the front running of Trump's trade war. So remember, he put a 10% tariff on a few hundred billion dollars of goods that was supposed to go to 25% on January 1st. And then it was supposed to go to 25% on March 1st. So what happened was you had a tremendous amount of front running of the trade war, the escalation of the trade war. And U.S. exports to China rose by 0.7% throughout 2018 for the year. And China's exports to the U.S. surged by 11%. So the Wall Street obsession over a trade war, I think, is ridiculous. Yes, if the trade tariffs went up to 25% and they stayed on for multiple quarters, that would depress trade and hence global GDP. But as of right now, the trade war is a red herring. It has actually helped global GDP. I'm just saying, right, the way this tariff was constructed, the way the trade war has emerged, it was one that engendered front running of an additional 15 percentage points of tariffs. So trade actually was increased in 2018. But here's what I don't understand. Let's talk about something that's even more important. What hurt the stock market in 2018 was not the trade war. It was central banks. And I went on record early last year, saying that the fall of 2018 was going to be a disaster for the economy and for the stock market. And the reason was primarily because of central bankers. You had the Fed raise rates 9 times since 2015 to the end of 2018. You had them destroy $500 billion worth of credit from their balance sheet. And that's not even the worst part of it, Chris. If you understand the mechanics of how this debt is destroyed, a central bank, a Federal Reserve in particular, owned an asset, a mortgage-backed security or a treasury bond. And guess what? The treasury didn't have to float that bond to the public. They didn't even have to pay interest on that debt. That interest is credited back to the treasury at the end of the year. But now the treasury is asked, once a bond matures from the central bank, hey, I have to now go and float this bond to the public at a public price. And then I have to service this debt. And then the Treasury sends that money to the Fed and the Fed destroys it. It's a very pernicious cycle going from QE to QT. That is what hurt the stock market primarily in 2018. Of course, you also had right on cue, the ECB, the European Central Bank, cut their QE off hard in December. That also concurrently hurt the stock market, globally speaking. And now we see the carnival barkers. I call them shills, permeables, and carnival barkers. All these people are coming on TV saying, don't you know the central banks of the world got your back? Let's go in and buy stocks hand over fist aggressively. But what about the business cycle, Chris? What about the fact that Japan, their growth rate for 2018 was 0.7%? Do you know what Germany's growth rate for Q4 was? 0.0%, Chris. Italy is in an official recession. Earnings growth for Q1 in the United States is going to be negative year over year, according to FactSet. Negative. Not just the second derivative isn't going from 20% to 10%. It's going below zero. There's no earnings growth in Q1. GDP print in Q4 and in Q1 is lucky to be growing at all. Q4 might be 1% and change, and Q1 2019 might be zero. So Wall Street is telling investors, hey, don't worry about anything. And the reason why you don't have to worry is because central banks have turned dovish. And I will say that they are leaning towards becoming dovish. But let's get this perfectly clear. The ECB ended QE in December. They are not back in QE yet. The Federal Reserve, they raised rates in December for the ninth time. And they are still in the process of destroying billions of dollars a month through that process I just described as quantitative tightening. And here's another thing I want to mention. It's one thing to say in 2009, Chris, hey, the central banks have turned dovish. They got your back. They are now going to lower interest rates. The Fed took interest rates from 5.25% to zero. And that kind of operation of lowering interest rates by hundreds of basis points was replete throughout the world. Let me ask you this. Can the ECB take away any debt service pain from the European consumer? They're at zero. Actually, they're at a negative discount rate right now. How about Japan? Japan is at a negative overnight lending rate. They have never ended QE. And even the Federal Reserve has 225, 250 basis points that they can remove of accommodation. So central bankers cannot, on a dime, turn this economy around that I just sort of proved to you is headed towards a recession, and they haven't even begun to try to go back into QE.
So starting with your carnival barker scenario, let's talk about P.T. Barnum, Jim Cramer. He's telling everybody, I love gold, buy gold. This thing's heading to 1,500. You know, let's just at least give him a little recognition for being someone who may be a barker, but he's right.
Well, here's the thing that I think you guys should really, guys and gals out there at Gold Teeth Radio should understand. It's profound, I'm going to tell you. This is the truth. The central bankers around the world entered into a zero interest rate policy for about a decade. It was around a decade. 2008, we started QE here in the United States. I believe it was 2014 where it ended, but we had a 0%, virtual 0% policy here all the way to the end of 2015. The European Central Bank went on a maniacal money printing spree, and they're at 0%, actually below zero. Japan is the same condition. And altogether, central banks printed around $15 trillion of counterfeit confetti to push up asset prices. So this is going on now, Chris, for about a decade. You know, as I said, these central banks really didn't get far off zero. And then not too long ago, for a brief period of time, very truncated period of time, especially in terms of the ECB, they only tried it for like, you know, a month. You know, the ECB ended QE in December. They're already talking about maybe going back into QE. But the Fed was able to sort of for like a year, maybe a year and a half, get serious about raising interest rates. They took it to 2.5, the Fed funds rate. And as I said, they drained about $500 billion from the balance sheet. And then after a decade of this incredible and unprecedented banana republic style of manipulation of the money markets, for one quarter, of a year. So pretty much from October to the end of the year, central bankers all caved. Okay? Their artificial world came crashing down. And I will tell you this. Why do you think they caved? Here's the truth. It wasn't because the non-farm payroll reports in the United States came in negative. You know, the Fed has a dual mandate of full employment and stable prices. Oh, they say stable prices, but now that means 2% inflation, you know. But it wasn't because people were getting laid off left and right. We have a record low unemployment rate, at least the way that the government calculates it and the way the Fed looks at things. 300 and some thousand non-farm payroll report in January. CPI was just below 2%. So why do you think central banks, in particular the Federal Reserve, changed their mind or at least started to lurch towards being dovish? Not fully dovish yet, but at least going in that direction. Well, I'll tell you why. It's because of what happened in the stock market and the high yield debt market from October till the end of the year. So here's the profound thing I want to tell you. Central banks have become wards of the stock market and of the credit markets. In other words, the middle class is being eviscerated. That trenchant gap between the wealthy, the most wealthy and the poor is going to get much, much wider. The middle class is becoming completely eviscerated and an endangered species list. And that's going to get much worse because central banks now have admitted that they can never get off zero and they can never stop QE. Of course, real terms, you know, you inflation adjust the CPI. The Federal Reserve is technically a little bit above inflation.
And you're assuming you believe their numbers, but okay.
Well, I'll play.
I'll play along.
Chris, good for you for jumping in there. I mean, I don't really believe their numbers at all, especially if you added a real housing number and a real, if you included asset prices such as stocks in the inflation calculation. But according to their calculation, they were able to get in real. But let me tell you something. You're at 0% all over the world and you have an inflation target of 2%? I mean, come on. This is what Jim Cramer got something right, Chris. We have been put on notice. And you want to know why gold is going up? We're going to put on notice that nominal rates can't get very far off zero and real rates are going to be profoundly negative for as far as the eye can see and getting even more so.
You know, that's important because if you have real rates in the negative column, basic economics says you've got to find shelter in gold.
Probably one of the biggest winners of 2019 so far. The only thing that's sort of saving the gold market from ripping to all-time highs in a matter of months is the relative strength and stickiness of the U.S. dollar because of the disastrous economic reports coming out of Europe primarily. I'm the kind of person that if something doesn't go right, I just work harder. I don't cower back. So I was short the market going into October of last year, did very, very well. I closed all my shorts out on December 24th. I then reshorted the market in early January. Nice bounce to reshort. So I have been, you know, my longs have been very, I'm long treasuries, short-term treasuries. So I'm long treasuries, I'm long gold, I'm long utilities.
Thank you, Michael Penta.
Thank you, Chris. Take care.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. Goldseek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Apmex and Sprott.com. One Gold holds physical gold and silver metals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. One Gold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals, distributed ledger, and blockchain technology. Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through One Gold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, One Gold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premiums. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales
of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click.
Vault Chain
offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Dr. Stephen Leeb, 3 decades of investment experience at least. He focuses on growth stocks and commodities. Former editor of Personal Finance, one of the most widely read financial newsletters, over 100,000 subscribers, author of an endless series of must-read books, including the one we're looking most forward to, his gold magnum opus. Welcome, Dr. Leeb.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
I was just, you know, fooling around on YouTube. And, you know, once you get on YouTube, you never get off. Start one music, and then they have other suggestions. And I came upon the 81 recording of Glenn Gould doing the Goldberg. And what they have, Chris, and anyone that's interested, they had motion pictures. I don't know what you call it today.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever, you know, they had a film of him. Yes, they had a film of him playing. Got the right words out. They had a film of him playing the 9-minute aria for Goldberg Variations, and this was a 1981 version. I was just mesmerized.
Do you know where he learned that? He had the world's most brilliant mentor.
He played that for a king. I think he wrote it for a king as a soporific to
yes.
put him to, you know.
Yes, Johann Sebastian Bach.
You have to watch him play this. It is, as I wrote to, you know, several friends who all of them know, well, one of them is my son, know much, much more about music than I do. I mean, they are true. I mean, some of them are great performers. Some of them are aficionados. This is 9 minutes of perfection. And it's really, you know, it sort of transcends humanity in the best ways. It's so remarkable watching this performance because you're just watching him alone in a studio. And, you know, the clarity of it. And listen, I'm not someone who knows a lot about music, okay? I'm lucky I can tell what note is higher, two notes, which one is higher than another. So I know very little about music, but I was just mesmerized. And you know, I just got a thing back from my son, Willie. He was mesmerized. I mean, people that know, that are really, really comfortable, that understand it so much better than I do, same thing. And it just take 9 minutes. You can download it on YouTube. Watch him.
He had the world's most amazing mentor. And his mentor taught him this style. Highly staccato.
That absolutely could be. And I did not know. I thank you very, very much for telling me. But no, I mean, yes, someone had to teach him. I mean, he didn't come out of the cradle knowing how to play Bach like. But the clarity with which he plays, his execution, even though, I mean, he learned it. I'm sure you're right. And he learned it from somebody else. But the clarity and the execution to me were just mind-numbing. I mean, literally. I mean, transcendent, I thought. I mean, and I have to confess my own ignorance. I never knew that was downloaded on YouTube. But he was so idiosyncratic. I mean, that one, what I knew about that is that Bernstein, at the beginning of that concert, said, you know, normally I would decline the invitation to conduct Glenn Gould or conduct anyone that is playing Brahms the way he's playing it. I think it was Brahms' Second Piano Concerto. And he said, but Glenn Gould is such a genius. Words to that effect.
Yeah.
That I.
But in my opinion, it was his mother. His mother took Glenn Gould
when
he was very young, could probably barely crawl, to play at the earliest of age. It's really one of the first things he remembers doing. And then they lived in a very, very remote provincial area by a lake, as you probably know, a very secluded life early on. And she taught him essentially lessons, probably 1, 2, 3 years old all throughout his early childhood. So he lived in a world of pure music.
Right. No, I mean, yes. I think in order to do whatever, in order to be as accomplished as that, it stunned me.
Probably had a touch of Asperger's, mild autism.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. I mean, he was not, yeah, for sure.
sure. I mean, yeah, he was not.
Not your everyday typical.
No, he's not an everyday Joe that you go around and have a beer with.
Yeah, you don't come over for beer at the Gold House.
No, you don't. But, you know, I do know people like him. But, yes, you're absolutely right. A touch of Asperger's, maybe a little stronger word than
higher up the
way
spectrum.
I may have defined it. But whatever. The music is, I mean, the clarity with which he executes that is something, it's preternatural. I mean, I've never.
What we in audio engineering refer to as pulse wave modulation. And what that means is you interpolate Johann Sebastian Bach's idea, the concept, and then you digitize it. In my opinion, he digitized Bach's pieces there, and it's
That's interesting, but he digitized, that's a very interesting, you know, interpretation, but he digitized it in his head.
Yeah.
And he digitized it with, you know, a certain way he wanted to express. I mean, there was a lot involved. And I don't think anyone this is a good argument for mind brain, that there's a mind there distinct from the brain. And, you know, Gould really displays that. I mean, you're not going to ever get an AI, in my opinion. OK, I know what's going to happen 1,000 years from now. I don't have no idea. But at least in my opinion, from what I read, and I stay up on this stuff pretty carefully, so far away from AI doing anything.
What if I told you I have 4.5-5 hours AI that plays keyboard as many as 18 to 19 keys simultaneously that I would argue rivals anything Bach, Chopin, Mozart?
I would have to hear it. Can tell you this.
What if I told you it was from another planet 1.5 billion years ago at tachyon speed?
Even more interesting.
And then you'd say, Chris, it's time for the meds. Get back on your meds.
I'm not a great chess player, but I do play chess. Study it. With actually one of the best Russian chess coaches. When he was in Russia, he was like, I think the youngest merited chess coach, which is
Karpov.
yes. In fact, he came with recommendations from both Kasp. You know, now we sort of just go over games. I mean, I'm not going to try and play against Michael. I mean, he would be, you know, it's a joke, okay? Because he's just really, you know, exceptional and probably could have been, you know, risen high in the ranks, but as a player, been among the best. But whatever. Long story, but he became a great coach, one of the best. And in Russia, chess is about as important a sport. Football is, it's a very, very important sport. So he was, you know, and I've been really, you know, blessed, you know, having taken lessons or studied with him for, I don't know, 20 years now. I couldn't believe it was 20 years. And after 20 years, you would have thought that I would be a great chess player by now, but I'm not.
If I just watch from the sidelines, it's like watching a good orchestra, just wishing I were in there, but loving the music, okay?
Right.
Well, my backstory is I had an injury really young, and I couldn't really participate in sports much anymore, so I took up chess. For about 7 years, no one could beat me, because frankly, nobody really played, right, at an early age. And then I came across this brilliant young lady from Hungary who was a transfer student. She was a few years older than me, transfer student from Hungary, staying with my Hungarian friends, the Kalmans, learned the subtleties and nuances.
Right. No, I never really played competitively. I mean, I did in college. I was on the Penn Wharton team, and I played against the other Ivy League. But and I wasn't terrible at it. But I was not, you know, I was not, like, really great. But now I'm at the point I cannot play extremely high level, but I am at the point where I can really understand what's going on in a championship chess match. Carlsen, Karana, not completely. I mean, but to some extent. I mean, I'm not left out when I'm watching a game. I mean, I don't know. I couldn't comment on it like the grandmasters do, but I, you know, I can follow it, which is really all I wanted to do. And then there's a reason that I was going to say this is because very often, Chris, when you watch these games that will give you the computer moves and the computer lines, and I can't say very often, but in many cases, you will see the human outplay the computer and actually find a move that is not among the top three that the computer lists, and it will turn out to be the best. This excites me because I don't want to believe that humanity has been totally thrumped, totally beaten.
And, you know, so far they're not. I mean, basically the computer will win in a game, but what they do, and it's just like, I think that we want to be beaten in a way. Because, yes, a computer, if you both have 2 hours, the computer is going to beat the human. If you both have 5 minutes, whatever. But computers don't have don't get nervous. They don't have to go to the bathroom. They're not distracted. They basically, you know, just calculate. And that's all they do is calculate. And very often, and there are the two best chess players, in my opinion, of the modern era are not Karpov and Kasparov. They would be Ivanchuk and probably Shirov. And on many occasions, these players will find moves that the computer just doesn't see. Now, that doesn't mean they can beat the computer. They cannot. But what they should do, if they were really trying to handicap it, is they should give the computer a half hour to play the entire game and give the human 6 hours. And that would make it fair. You know, then you'd get some idea. And I might turn out to have, you know, be totally completely wrong. It won't make any difference. I still think, I mean, and again, I am biased toward this, that we humans can still hold our own against the machines. That's what I really, really want to believe. I guess that's why I want to leave the earth with a smile on my face, believing that humans can still hold their own. Doesn't mean that AI is not a great, great thing and won't, you know, be great to humanity. But I still think that in many, many tasks that the humans have the edge. If that's AI, you know, probably, yeah. It's, at least to my ears, it's hard for me to ever imagine anyone mesmerizing me to the extent that Glenn Gould did for those 9 minutes. And I just picked it up for the first time. I mean, shame on me. I should have known that was on YouTube. And Michael, the chess coach, is one of those guys that really, really understands music, Russian, et cetera, et cetera. He was very angry at me. He said, I told you about this, whatever. Well, the story that he told me is that when Glenn Gould appeared in Russia, he did perform in Russia, in St. Petersburg. No one really knew him, but, you know, the Russians really, really loved music. And in the first, he did that. His concert had two halves. Well, any concert has two halves, but a half and then a break and then second half. First half, the audience was very sparse. One, I'm just making this up, but, you know, two or three people a row. By the time the second half, there may have been a 10-minute intermission, it was packed. I mean, people evidently got on their phone and they said, this is the most amazing thing I've ever heard. And he, you know, by the time Gould came out for the second half of the performance, couldn't get in. I mean, it was just like jam-packed. I mean, the word spread that fast, and that's not really apocryphal. That is, I absolutely believe Michael that I don't know what he, you know, that was true. Evidently, to see him, because he didn't perform very much. I mean, in the early part of his career, but the later part of his career, like in 1981, when these Goldberg Variations were out, he wasn't performing. He was doing everything in the studio, where he felt he had much more control. So maybe you're right about that business, about control and staccato and all that other stuff. Maybe that he just felt that he could not be his best. I think you're probably very right about that. It's a really, really good point. That might explain why he was unwilling to perform, had enough control over, you know, how he struck the keys, everything else that had to be perfect. And maybe there were other takes that we, you know, we don't know about. That's interesting, Chris. It really is. I'll send you a YouTube of the recent Russian phenom, pianist called Trivanov, who's like 27, and he also is just totally amazing, but in a different sort of way. But I'll include you on my list of more about music than I do and can really appreciate this stuff. For me, it takes the outer ends of spectacular for me to appreciate, but you guys that know a lot about music can appreciate it. Really, really good playing. So anything that crosses or anything Michael mentions to me or anyone else, I'll send you.
I'd love to hear your take on the markets. Maybe we could start with either U.S. equities or precious metals.
The world is scared to death right now. There's going to be some sort of major fall in the economies that China, I mean, for the last 10 years, I mean, I've gone back on the internet and Stratford about a decade ago that said China was not going to get through this decade. Jim Chanos, I mean, everybody basically has nothing good to ever say about China. It's always on the cusp of some sort of catastrophe. It is not. One reason not to believe that the world is on the cusp of a catastrophe is China is not. And at least in some respects, China is the largest economy in the world, purchasing power parity, et cetera. But, in you know, even if you measure in terms of dollars, they're the second largest economy, the biggest trader. They do twice as much trading with the with their BRI, the Belt Initiative. Those countries that make up that initiative now count for twice as much trading as they do with the U.S. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I think these trade talks will work out. I mean, and I've felt that for quite some time. I don't think China would benefit from any kind of trade war, and certainly we will not. So I think China, they've slowed down a little bit, sort of have put on the accelerator. They're a little bit more monetary stimulation, be more physical stimulation, and I think they're going to be okay. As indicated yesterday, the U.S. is also, you know, went from hawkish to dovish. They are now, you know, in stimulating their economies. Even Germany, because, you know, they've sort of minor, I would say relatively minor casualty of these trade wars or trade tariffs, et cetera. They've slowed down considerably. They're also trying to speed things up. Really, most of Europe, I mean, Europe is, if you had to look at a big segment of the world's economy, Europe would stand out as the real slowpoke. I mean, there's been, you know, definite slowdown. But most of that slowdown is not in, even Spain is doing okay. Italy has a problem. And Germany has a problem, but if you take those two economies out, most of Europe is doing fairly well. Italy, I don't know what's going to happen in Italy. I'm not going to even try and guess. But Germany, they have so much money, they can afford to speed things up. And wherever you look in the world, you see countries taking pro-growth policy steps. And it's hard for me to imagine that all these are going to come to naught. I think that, you know, already in China, you're starting to see signs that things are perking up. I mean, people say China's dead. Retail sales are growing over 8% a year. I mean, that's a lot. And they've got like, I don't know, 400 million people that are sort of coming up in the game in the western part of the economy, western part of the country. I mean, so I think that between the U.S., between China, India, their growth is faster than China's. Japan has kind of always been slow, but they too are starting to take steps to, you know, speed things up. If your baseline right now, I mean, the forecasts were recently dropped. I think the World Bank dropped their forecast to about 2.9 from 3. I think those are low. I think you're going to see much higher growth than what, you know, most of the organizations, the World Bank, IMF, most of the worldwide organizations are saying. And with that stronger growth, I think you're going to see much real perky economy, commodities. And I think gold, for lots of reasons, is going to be in the lead. I mean, I think that one of the things China wants, and I can understand this, they want gold to be sort of the center of a monetary system. And, you know, lots of reasons. They have a, what, three or 4,000 year history with gold and, you know, to some extent silver, et cetera. And, but more important, the sanctions, the U.S., I mean, and there's a lot of good things about America, and I just wish we would come back. I mean, I really do. I mean, I remember America when they had their own state, when we had our own state organizations, our state-owned organizations, our state-monitored or state-run organizations. One of them was called AT&T. This is not the AT&T that we know of today, but this was the AT&T that included Western Electric, which provided all the cabling, the communications that took place in that country. This was also the AT&T that ran Bell Labs. I mean, much of the great technology that this country has created, and we did create the technology, we created the foundation for modern IT, but this was created as a consortium of AT&T, DARPA, the Defense Department research arm, and other schools. So in particular, MIT was involved. The transistor came out of that. Superconductivity came out of there. The internet actually came out of there. The laser came out of there. Out of this one laboratory. It was probably the greatest research laboratory of all time. And if you really want to get upset, and what really does upset me is that see Huawei phones. And I mean, I hate to say this, but going, if you go to websites that measure, you know, how good these phones are, Huawei turns out to be number one. They're better than Apple. They're better than Samsung. And it, but not by a little bit. It's like Glenn Gould and, you know, the second or third best pianist, you know, playing Bach. It's really, you know, a distinct difference. Back in 1957, you're too young to remember this. Unfortunately, I barely remember it, but I do remember it a little bit. Russia launched something called Sputnik, and that's gone down as a Sputnik moment. Now, I may have mentioned this before, but compare how we responded in 57 to Sputnik. Compare and contrast with how we're responding today to Huawei. Sputnik one-upped us. Russia one-upped us by launching a satellite that was orbiting the Earth. And how did we respond? Well, we got on our – rolled up our sleeves. We initiated, you know, in today's dollars, tens of billions probably on education, development of technologies of all sorts. And we had Bell Labs there kind of turbocharging everything. And between 57 and I think it was 68, we went from not being able to launch anything that would orbit the Earth to landing a man on the moon. We left the Russians behind by a mile. I don't see any of that sort of elan, that sort of like confidence that, okay, the Chinese have this really good stuff. Now let's one-up them. Maybe we'll not one-up them, but at least let's try. Let's say, what's wrong with our education? I mean, I think there are things that are wrong with our education. We really could. And our university, the way we give grants, if you want to make tenure in a top university, I mean, you've got to write 30 articles. It doesn't really matter whether they're good or bad articles. I mean, it's just the whole notion of how we, you know, judge and motivate people. We've got to find somebody that can sort of take us, really lead us to, you know, a higher level, because I think we're capable of doing it. So, you know, my take is that basically I think that the world is in pretty good shape. I also think that, you know, China and the U.S., and I think this is really, really important, China and the U.S. can work together. I don't think China is looking to dominate the world. Forget about that. They don't want it. They don't need it. They're looking for the best way of life for their people. And I think we should be doing about the same thing. And I think that our focus should be on being the best again. So basically, I'm bullish on commodities, basically bullish on stocks. Growth will be higher than people are expecting it. I don't think we're going to let inflation upset the apple cart. In other words, if inflation goes up to 3%, I think we'll tolerate it. This is not going to be a Volcker-type era where, you know, we stop inflation at all costs. I think that hopefully what we do at all costs is try and become number one in various, like AI, for instance. I mean, you know, we can do that.
You know what President Putin said about AI, right?
What? No.
That whoever controls AI will control the world.
Yes, and, you know, that could – look, he has a good point. I think AI is – like I said, I don't think AI replaces humans. That's my opinion. You know, we could debate that later. I mean, you know, that's just my belief. But I feel just as strongly that AI can be a massive help to anybody. And that, you know, if some country controls AI, they're going to have a huge edge. And if China ends up controlling, you know, this next evolution of the internet or, you know, interconnectivity, 5G, which they appear to be on the verge of doing, you know, that's going to give them an edge up, a leg up. And I think we've got to be set to beat them. And you're not going to beat them by banning Huawei. I mean, there is no evidence. Look, I'm not saying this because I'm not pro-China. I'm not. I'm pro-humanity. I'm pro-U.S. But there is no evidence that Huawei is any more crooked than any other company. I'm not saying that they're saints. But, I mean, they didn't. There's no evidence they ever stole anything. The one case that the U.S. has criminalized, and I don't think people realize this when they say Huawei, you know, committed these crimes, the one case that they're accused of criminalizing, this was a case that had already been settled, like, I think, 5 years ago in a civil court. And it was settled for a few million dollars.
You know, what's also interesting, I think I may have mentioned this before, some of the most interesting science fiction is written by this Chinese author. He wrote The Three-Body Problem. That's the name of the book. It's actually a three-volume book called The Three-Body Problem. It's just fascinating in terms of what they conceive of as possible in the future. I mean, you know, I'm talking thousands of years into the future. And when you read this, you get it sort of opens your eyes to, you know, things like the simulation problem and other things. And I would really recommend it if you like.
His name is Liu, and I'm going to mispronounce it. It's like Qin.
Well, that's why I didn't say his name. I'll never say a Chinese name. The only name I will say that I can, my next door neighbor's name is Ping. The only Chinese name I can say.
So we'll post that for everybody because I know they'll want to take a look.
Chris, thanks a million. It was a great pleasure, and I'm really happy about your family and everything.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. GoldSeek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. OneGold holds physical gold and silver medals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. OneGold uses VaultChain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals, distributed ledger, and blockchain technology. VaultChain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through OneGold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, OneGold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premium. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. VaultChain offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. A recent conversation on Laura Ingraham's podcast channel was with former federal prosecutor Joe DeGeneva, who was one of my favorite cut to the chase, call it like it is, inside the Beltway Voices of Reason that still exists inside a swamp that refuses to be drained. He made a rather succinct comment on the state of the mainstream media in our country today, which I define as the majority of talking heads and those who would whisper in their earpiece and write the scripts that are read on air. Those who are part of the six corporations that now control and manage the narrative for over 90% of what we see and hear as national news. And I use that term lightly, because national news is often re-reported on the local and regional levels, because local media has very little, if any, resources nowadays to do original reporting or investigations of their own, and as a result often rely on what is sent to them through the official news pipeline further upstream. The problem in that scenario is that the battle for your mind, the battle to manage and control your opinion and what you think about, that battle is out of control. Back in the 1980s, Ted Turner gave us 24/7 news. Now that original good idea has mutated itself, and the monster is loose, attempting to cram your psyche into predefined molds of what the narrators want reality to be, instead of reflecting what it actually is. Today, the media not only wants to report the news, they want to create it as well. and arbitrate what ideas you and I even get to think about and consider. In Joe DeGeneva's discussion with Laura Ingraham, he said that there is nothing more dangerous to a country than a corrupt media which misreports information, takes sides, and pretends that it is being objective. He went on to say that the press is not the enemy of the people, but rather they are the enemy of themselves, in that they are the enemy of the First Amendment and the enemy of free speech. I have discussed in earlier commentaries how the root of what we are experiencing today in terms of consolidation of the media and what has become consolidation of free speech is rooted in the Telecommunications Act of 1996. But I digress. Just like CDs were disrupted by downloadable content, and downloadable content was disrupted by direct peer-to-peer communication via your computer and smartphone, so too we must plan for the next disruption in the rapidly changing communication landscape in which we are immersed, so that the pendulum toward censorship and centralized control of what we think and communicate to one another swings back toward freedom and is allowed to flourish and triumph without interference from those who would censor your freedom to think. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. GoldSeek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. One Gold holds physical gold and silver medals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. One Gold uses VaultChain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals, distributed ledger, and blockchain technology. VaultChain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through One Gold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, One Gold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premiums. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. VaultChain offers the best tier pricing on Atmex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.